Lunchtime Live with Andrea Gilligan on News Talk. Ask the GP on Lunchtime Live.
Yes, Dr. Nina Burns, who's a GP at Generation Health Medical Clinic, is with me today to answer all of your questions. Nina, how are you?
Good to be here.
Yeah,
well,
all good. You. Brilliant. Yep. 087 1400 106. That's the WhatsApp number if you have a question for Nina today. I have my own one, first of all, because I burnt my arm. I don't know what I was, well, I do know what I was doing. I was reaching behind the back of the toaster. I didn't even realise that, you know, the top part of it was so hot. I have a huge burn and scar and mark on my arm, and I've been putting Burn Shield on it all week. It has massively reduced, but what do you recommend for to try and prevent scarring?
Yeah, they can be very sore, isn't it?
And you
don't
really
always forget scarring. I have a bad, that was a burn of a kettle when I was about 12. I
really?
Have kind of a scar right on my wrist. Yeah, they can be sore, and the key is, I suppose, to sort the pain and the burning. So, you know, straight away when it happens, obviously something cold onto it to cool it down, run it under water, ice pack or whatever. What I find quite good, actually, you know, is if you have an aloe vera plant in your house, cut a bit off, squeeze a bit of the gel, pop that on. You can buy aloe vera gels. It's all about soothing it. I mean, the skin heals itself, and unfortunately, it's not always possible to avoid a scar. It just depends on how superficial it is. It'll be red for quite a while. I mean, that's just your skin sore. But anything that kind of soothes it and moisturises it, you can go into the pharmacy. There are lots of remedies that they'll sell you specifically for burns. But yeah, you know, I think aloe vera, any of those kind of after sun kind of things, anything that cools it. I always say to people, you know, chop a bit of aloe vera, stick it in the fridge and then put a bit of gel on. It soothes it. But as regards scarring, unfortunately, I don't have anything specific.
Hope.
Yeah, it's not too deep, but did it blister at the time?
No, just about prevented it from blistering.
Yeah, so if it didn't blister,
yeah, it's not
quite
as sore now, but it's still
quite
red.
But it's like a carpet burn. Sometimes the more superficial, the more stingy it is, you know.
Listener is wondering about treating plantar fasciitis. They're icing, massaging, resting and stretching their foot. It's still sore. They have it for weeks. It's really starting to get them down because they can't walk or run.
You know, plantar fasciitis is really common.
It's desperate, isn't
it? It's a really good reminder of, you know, just because something isn't considered serious doesn't mean it doesn't cause you distress. Because obviously plantar fasciitis is not something that you're going to die from. It's not something serious as in going to cause you disability. But boy, does it cause problems for people.
What actually is it, Nina?
So the fascia is sort of this thick, it's hard to describe, sort of tissue that lies under your skin, over your muscles and tendons. It's kind of like the casing of your foot under the skin. And it can get inflamed and irritated. And classically, it's when you get up in the morning, you put your feet to the ground, you get this pain. And obviously, when you're upright, your feet are on the ground. So people who have it, they're uncomfortable walking. You see it sometimes in people who run or exercise. And, you know, a lot of these are people who just love running for their head and, you know, to keep fit. And they get really distressed because the treatment is rest. The treatment is not doing what they want to do, which is be upright and moving. Sounds like this person has had good advice. They're massaging it, icing it, resting it and stretching. You know, people say get the water bottle and roll your foot back and forth on the water bottle. I would say go to physio. They sometimes do ultrasound treatment to just kind of reduce the inflammation. Taking over-the-counter anti-inflammatories can help if that's something you can do. Very, very rarely, you know, they will inject it, but they really don't do that very often and it doesn't always work. And that's quite an uncomfortable treatment to have.
God.
The only good news, and I know it's really hard for people who are in the middle of it, is it does normally go away, but how long it stays varies hugely from person to person. And that's the issue.
Another texter has mucus at the back of their throat that they can't get up, pain over their eyes, soreness at the back of their head. They've tried gargling warm water with salt, taken honey, lemon every single morning, Nina, and nothing has happened. The back of their head is sore as well. So have you any advice, please?
So I suppose it'd be interesting to see how long this is going on. I suppose these symptoms would very much fit with an upper respiratory tract infection where your sinuses are just congested. And remember, you know, if our skulls were completely solid, we wouldn't be able to hold up the weight of them. So we have these holes in our skull that are air pockets, but, you know, they can get infected and they can get fluid in them and they literally make your head heavy when you feel really, really unwell with it. So go to the pharmacy. Things like antihistamines, if you know, there are a couple of decongestants, those don't suit everyone. So you need to be advised by a pharmacist or doctor if they're suitable for you. They can help. And, you know, you can go to your GP. There are sort of more long term nasal sprays sometimes you can use to help clear the sinuses. If this is something that's going on a long time, occasionally you get a scan of your sinuses done to make sure you don't have big polyps or something there that are blocking it. And, you know, occasionally you need antibiotics, although in the majority of cases, antibiotics are not needed, actually. A lot of people assume an antibiotic will fix it. But antibiotics only kill bacteria. They don't treat congestion, and it's the congestion causes that pain and discomfort.
Listeners 46, they've had an ache and a pain at times in their right hand. They've had blood tests done at the time for arthritis. Nothing showed up. They're now crippled with hip pain, wake up at night. They've been to an osteopath who said it's not a trapped nerve. They have hand finger pain, cramping when holding the steering wheel, often cramps in their fingers and elbows too when holding the hairdryer up to dry their hair. Should they get orthotic bloods done again, or what thoughts have you?
So I suppose it's interesting to know, I think they said it was one hand, did they?
Yeah, just the right hand they mentioned.
So, you know, there are different types of arthritis. There's inflammatory arthritis, which is rheumatoid arthritis. It tends to hit both sides. So usually people will come in and they've pain in both hands or both knees or both hips. That's the inflammation one, and that's the one that's going to show up on blood tests. Osteoarthritis, which is wear and tear, tends to be more, although not always, one-sided. You might have it in one joint and not in another. And I suppose you can be examined, and there are different features of the examination would suggest one way or another. I suppose that the fact that this person says there's a cramping in the hands and a numbness, I think, did they say numbness as well?
Yeah.
I think.
Well,
or a weakness.
Weakness, sorry.
You know, sometimes when it's the arm, actually, it can be coming from the neck. Remember, you know, all the nerves come out of our head into our spinal cord and then down into our body. So I suppose it'd be worth going along to your doctor, or physios would be very good at assessing this as well, being examined, and they'll help pinpoint where they think the issue is,
okay,
and whether it's just local inflammation and exercises and strengthening might help, or whether there's a pinched nerve that might need to be looked into a bit more.
My wife was diagnosed with epilepsy. What should I do during an attack? Place in the reposition or leave her lying on her back? I'm worried that my wife will choke on liquid in her mouth during an attack if she was on her back. Very concerned, I'm sure.
Yes, the family members of people who have seizures always worry a lot about what to do and are they doing everything right. And, you know, seizures are very difficult. Most seizures are short-lived, thankfully. So actually, often by the time you start thinking about what way to put the person in that, the seizure might be easing. But in general, you know, you try and keep them safe. So you don't want to try and move them. If you have to move them to get them somewhere safe, that's probably not good. But you usually try and at least have something under their head, you know, so they don't kind of hit their head off the ground. Usually we'd say on your side, and obviously have the things available that if the seizure is going on longer than 5 minutes, you'd usually have a prescription of something that you can give to help stop the seizure. The Irish Epilepsy Society, the website, they have very good information for family members on how to manage that, and obviously talk to the doctor. But it is, you know, it's carers, they worry so much about this. And thankfully, in the majority of cases, a lot of seizures are quite short lived. Mm-hmm. So although it happens quite dramatically, it's gone. And the most important thing is just to make sure that they're safe, that there's nothing around. But yes, we generally try and say on recovery, but that can be hard to do if someone's actively seizing. You know, you don't want to be shoving them and damage them in that either.
Now, another listener is wondering about their 15-year-old daughter, Nina, who is a bedwetter since she was 4 or 5 years of age, has very few dry nights. She still wets the bed 7 nights a week. We've tried everything with no positive outcomes. So have you any thoughts for a 15-year-old?
It's very distressing for a teenager to be bedwetting, because there's the whole kind of psychological side of it at that age, and they start to have a very kind of negative self-image. So it is important to address it. Bedwetting, you know, it commonly runs in families, actually. And while most children are dry, you know, from sort of the age of 3, 4, some not, and a small percentage continue to wet into the preteens, and a very small percentage into their teens. So go along to your doctor. There are some examinations that they will do. They will take a proper history of her, examine her, make sure there's nothing else going on that's leading to this, and then try and address it. You know, if there's a psychological element, going for counselling can help with that. Obviously, and I'm sure most people, when they are coming to you in desperation, they've tried everything. They've done the star charts. They've done the kind of, you can buy these alarms that will go off when the bed is wet. It's important that when someone wets, you know, you want to know, are they waking up when they're wet? If they're waking when they're wet, that's a good sign. It means they're aware it's happened. And sometimes that kind of bladder training, always going to the toilet before bed, not drinking fluids late in the evening, all of those things remain important throughout our lives for everybody. But, you know, at 15, if it's still going on 7 nights a week, I think it's worth looking at getting some bloods, and we do sometimes refer on to specialists and they can prescribe different things that might help.
Okay. Yeah. My eyes won't stop weeping, says this texter. I've tried all different drops. None of them work. I got a letter in January saying I was on the list, so I rang them last week and the guy I spoke to told me it'll be 2026 before I'm seen. I can't wear makeup. Can the doctor please suggest anything?
Wow, that's a long wait. Unfortunately, that's a story we hear very often. I suppose the reason the wait is so long is this, thankfully, is not considered an urgent condition. But again, it's another example of, you know, although it won't kill you, it's causing distress. Weirdly, watering eyes are often a sign of dry eyes. So that's where the drops come in, and using drops can help. But you can, and again, I don't think this person said their age, you can get congested tear ducts. And sometimes the tear duct needs to be probed or cleared, which obviously is something done by a specialist. Yeah, it's a hard one.
So they need to wait to get to the specialist, really, do they?
Yeah, unfortunately. Well,
Is it 2026 for a specialist to an eye?
Seems very long. I'm not sure where they are in the country, or you know, the GP, I suppose. You know, we're always getting letters to write a stronger letter. I don't think that really makes a difference. But, you know, checking in with them, checking where you're on the list, and definitely trying different drops. Sometimes anti-allergy drops can help a little bit. There are a few other kind of drops we can try. Your GP might know there might be some, you know, opticians or GPs with special interests around the country that might have an interest in something like that. But the tear duct probing is usually done by a specialist.
The specialist. 087 1400 106 is the WhatsApp number. If you have a question for Dr. Nina Burns, this listener is on antibiotics for strep throat. They were going to buy probiotics, but somebody mentioned they shouldn't take antibiotics with probiotics at the same time. Is that true?
Well, so probiotics obviously are delivering good bacteria to your gut, and certain antibiotics obviously disrupt the gut bacteria. I would say the same timepiece means exactly at the same moment, because probiotics don't tend to be absorbed as such. They act very locally in the gut usually, whereas antibiotics, obviously you want them absorbed and you want their benefits. So, I mean, unless you're swallowing them at exactly the same time, I don't see a reason.
I presume that, I thought they meant that, can you take probiotics when you're on a course of antibiotics?
Yeah, so I mean, people take probiotics all the time, and you know, we still prescribe antibiotics for people. So it's just, I can't think of any reason why the antibiotic you would get for strep, it's what we call a very narrow spectrum antibiotic. Usually the one we get for strep is plain penicillin. It doesn't actually cause massive disruption to the gut bacteria, that one. And I can't think why you wouldn't be absorbing your penicillin by being on a probiotic at the same time. I wouldn't, you know, I would say maybe don't swallow the tablets at the same time. But
this texter says their husband has a constant blocked nose. He's had antibiotics twice, which hasn't helped. Could a sleep apnea machine have caused the problem?
So I don't know that it would have caused the problem. And you know, sleep apnea machines have improved dramatically. Now, I'm not a sleep physician, and I haven't seen a lot of the machines recently, but I know from talking to patients who have them, they're certainly better than they used to be. But there still is this mask and the air, and they can dry the airway, which obviously a dry airway can be an irritated airway. So sometimes using kind of, you can buy moisturizing drops and that for the nose can help. So whether it's the irritation in the nose is causing the congestion, which technically is a knock-on effect of the sleep apnea machine, but I wouldn't sort of blame the sleep apnea machine as such.
Okay. Anything I can do to help with heartburn during pregnancy? I'm eating small meals and exercising, but still get it after every meal. This listener is wondering, can they take Rennie's or Gaviscon?
So the short answer to that is yes, but this is a great question, and thanks for asking it, because it's really common. And obviously people, when they're pregnant, they want to be as healthy as possible, and they're often worried about taking medication. And there's two reasons you get heartburn in pregnancy. So the hormone levels, they relax. Sphincters, one being the one at the bottom of the esophagus, so it's almost easier for acid to come up. And secondly, as the baby gets bigger, they're literally pushing up on your stomach. So Rennie's, Gaviscon, any of those over-the-counter remedies are quite safe. And actually, some of the prescription remedies that we use for heartburn, we do prescribe in pregnancy, and they're considered safe. So this is not something that someone who's pregnant needs to suffer with.
Another listener is 16, Nina, and they've hot flushes for 10 years. When do they go away?
Wow, that's a tough one, isn't it? 60 and 10 years. So the general consensus would be that menopause, you know, 85% of women, their symptoms are gone within 5 years. But that 15% left over, how long do they go on after that? It's very hard to know. In the majority of people, they ease. But again, you know, go talk to your GP, talk about your quality of life. There are some options out there. And, you know, sometimes the tiniest dose of hormones is the option to help with those. So again, this is not something that you have to suffer in distress with. And obviously, there are lots of other causes of sweats and flushes. So if they've changed in character, if they're not the same as they were before, that's definitely worth talking about too.
Okay. Dr. Nina Burns, GP at Generation Health Medical Clinic. Nina, thanks a million for joining us here for this Monday's Ask the GP.
Lunchtime Live with Andrea Gilligan. Weekdays at midday on News Talk.